So Derek. Derek is a Los Angeles native, longtime San Diegan, and he's an active investor, award-winning realtor, and he is the business development director at the North San Diego Real Estate Investors Club out in North San Diego. We've tried really hard also to get people from all over Southern California. So on the panels today, you'll notice LA, Orange County, San Diego, and the Inland Empire. Derek has been involved in many real estate strategies, everything from auctions, short sales, REOs, owner financing, mobile home parks, lending, development, and apartment buildings. And he is currently president of Trinity Investment Services LLC and a managing partner of Sunoco Corporation. Kimberly Nelson also helped us with this chapter. She is the partner to Derek. She could not be here today, but I really appreciate her information and help in developing this. I've always been attracted to their beautiful work that they've done in San Diego, adding square footage. I love their before and afters. If you look, it doesn't even look like the same property. So we will be doing a radio show with the two of you so we can end up hearing a little bit more about your background and how you got started in the design process. But if we can give a warm welcome to Derek, and we will get started.
Hey, this thing on? Yes, you guys can hear me. All right. Thank you, Aaron, for having me. Wow, that's bright. I know how hard you work to put this on. Seeing what Aaron's had to do in the last couple months to just get these things together, like the workbook you guys have, the slides, I mean, everything is a lot of work. So when you get a minute, shake Aaron's hand because he works really hard on these things. Okay. So first off, I would like to mention Matt and Joe and their mobile home parks. I don't personally know them, but I do know mobile home parks. I've owned four of them, and they're really awesome niches. And if your interest was piqued by hearing what they had to say, highly recommend you do some more diligence, network, meet some people who are doing it. They can be cash cows, they can be a whole different beast, and it can be a lot of trouble. But at the end of the day, they're really good investments. And if you're interested, highly recommend you look deeper. I also want to mention what they mentioned also about Gary Johnson. So this is a shameless plug. Gary Johnson's Financial Freedom Principles training changed my life, and everyone I know who went, it says the same thing. Like, it's like a mandatory seminar to take. Ask anybody in this room that's gone, and they'll probably tell you the same. So, okay, first off, like, good on all you guys to being here today. Like, I know you probably hear this a lot. You're at seminars, you're at trainings, whatever it is, but it's not easy to get up early on a Saturday morning and go to a seminar to listen to people talk and take notes and read a pamphlet. But it is immeasurable the types of things it'll bring back to you. So for me personally, at local real estate investor associations, I've met partners, I've met mentors, I've met people who have taught me a lot, have saved me a lot of money, and also just made some friends. So it's really good on you guys for being here. You know, this is a form of continuing education. If you guys have day jobs, I'm sure you're required to continue your education. If you're in real estate, it's the same thing. So this is really good. And you know, my dad always taught me that when I go to these seminars, if I take one thing away or I meet one person, just that one thing or that one person, it was worth the price of admission and then some. So as long as you leave here with that one nugget, like, it was worth it. So, and don't discount the seminar in the hallway. So the people in this room are people you need to be around, right? You're all paying to go to an educational event, right? Like, that takes a commitment. That takes a certain type of person, a certain mindset and mentality. Like, we are the people we all want to be around. So definitely don't discount that. All right, so starting to get more towards the topic today, the adding square footage, zoning, et cetera, I want to first point out that I can't cover everything. You know, we have 90 minutes, and you know, zoning is like, could take 6 months to learn about zoning, and same with adding square footage. There's just so much to unpack that I can't realistically do it in 90 minutes. But what I put together in terms of my notes is a little, so the outline that Aaron constructed, I kind of took that and then went through and made a bunch of my own notes and suggestions that I'm going to be explaining to all you guys today that are not on the slides. They're just things that I've run into, encountered, and have seen on the front lines. So if you guys like what you hear, taking notes would probably be a good idea because of that stuff won't be in front of you. And again, I'm easily accessible. If there's anything you guys ever like want to talk about later, tomorrow, next week, whatever, just hit me up and we'll exchange information and we'll go from there. Again, just a little more logistical stuff here. So housekeeping, Aaron mentioned my partner, Kimberly Nelson. So she's the yin to my yang. We have a very good relationship in what we do. On our business, I'm more of like the find the deals, fund them, underwrite them kind of guy. And she's really on the design side, managing the contractors and the jobs and the materials and the colors and all that. So it's a really good fit because I'm colorblind and can barely dress myself. So I can't do any of that stuff. So I would suggest too, if you're getting into this and you're gonna start surrounding yourself with people who can help you get where you wanna go, surround yourself with the people who don't have the skills you have that you guys can kind of work together. All right. And then lastly, plug to Jim Sowards. So Jim is my partner Kimberly's father. He was a friend of Bruce's, a friend of my father's, and he was a true guru, right? That term is thrown around loosely in the real estate investor circuit. Like, what does that really mean? I'm not sure, but he was probably the most creative deal structurer I've ever met and just a wealth of knowledge, and without him, I wouldn't be here today. All right, so kind of generally speaking, like, I'm always learning something new. Like, I've been doing this for a little while. I've made some really good projects. We made some good profits. We've also made some mistakes and lost money on stuff, and it happens. But I'm always learning. I'm always trying to take what went well or what went wrong and apply it to our next deal. So make sure you guys understand that when you're doing this. Like, this is a process. You're not always going to win, but make sure you, whatever it is you do, you learn from it. Okay, so in San Diego is where I'm based out of right now. So a lot of what you're gonna hear from me is taken from what we've encountered in San Diego County. A lot of it will apply to LA, Inland Empire, Orange County, but some of it may not. And as I get through this, you'll see that when it comes to zoning and building and planning departments, whatever it is, they vary very drastically from city to city, from county to county. Sometimes even across the street from each other, they'll have different requirements. So you have to be very cognizant of that. But I am San Diego based. All right, so to cover what I'm going to cover today is basically zoning, how that affects you, what it is, adding square footage to create equity. Like, you hear that a lot now, right? Like, hey, I can buy a property that's a small 1,000 square feet, two bedroom, one bath, and I can add 500 square feet, and I can build it at $200 a foot, and I can sell it at $500 a foot, and I can create this arbitrage and all this equity. And I mean, it's tough because it doesn't always quite work out that way. So, and I'm going to unpack some of that and show you why. So, okay. I'm also going to briefly talk about ADUs. ADU means accessory dwelling units. I'm not going to steal the thunder for the people going up here later today, but it kind of packs into what adding square footage is now. So I'm going to touch on a couple things, and it'll be a good precursor for what you guys are going to learn this afternoon. All right, so I also want to start by saying, too, have fun with this, you guys. It's like, real estate is an awesome way to make a lot of money, and it's a great way to have that financial freedom you're looking for. And don't be intimidated, because so many times when I was getting started, and I know there's a lot of experienced people in the room that'll probably attest to that, like, you'll see all these formulas and all these things of what not to do, and you get scared, and you just, you know, you kind of grow up in a ball and you don't want to do it. But you really have to get that fear aside and make calculated steps in the right direction and get out there and do something, because, I mean, there really is an awesome world of real estate out there. Okay, so there are several ways to do this, to create equity. So you can take advantage of zoning changes, you can find properties and add square footage, and you could tear down an existing house and build a new one. Now, you'll see the second bullet point there says an upscale area. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that. Well, I guess I can't say I don't agree with it, because that is a good model, but there are lots of opportunities in areas that are not upscale or affluent. So I'll mention that in a little bit later. So zoning. I think that to really get into this, you gotta understand what zoning is. And I mean, when I really first took a look at zoning, I mean, I thought I knew what it was. I thought I knew kind of how it affected me. And to be honest, like, I still don't. It's so confusing. It's a very complicated language that you need to learn how to speak. And even the best architects and people down in the planning department don't quite speak it fluently. So in a nutshell, zoning is like regulations and restrictions that municipalities will use to regulate what can be built on a certain parcel of land. And so common zoning areas will include like residential or commercial
or industrial. And typically you're not going to see like a major industrial zone directly butted up against, you know, a residential area. And so that's the whole point, is just to make sure that land use is done properly. So the good thing about zoning is that it doesn't change overnight. And in San Diego specifically, it almost never happened on a large scale, and until recently. And what created that? So the housing crunch, right, is what created that. There are tenants that don't have places to rent. There are homeowners that are looking, or potential homeowners looking for places to buy, and there's just not enough of it. So the city had to respond. So what did they do? They started looking at the current areas, and they said, well, how can we shift some of these zoning laws to now create more density or allow more units within the same area, or reduce some of the restrictions that developers face to build this extra these extra homes, these extra dwelling units. So what sometimes you'll see is you'll see zoning get changed from R1 to R2 to R3 or back and vice versa. And I say that with an asterisk because, like, I used to think that R2, right? People would hear that, oh, this property is zoned R2. Cool, that means you can build two units. Well, wrong. It may mean you can build two units, but it may not. So just because if your property says it's zoned R2 or R3 doesn't necessarily mean that's what you can build. So you want to dive into that a little bit. So so going down, like, zoning is a language, and you really have to speak it. And I'll give you a good example right now. So, like, we have a property right now that we're planning on doing an accessory dwelling unit on. And when I put the property under contract, I started doing my homework, and I noticed that this property is zoned twice. And the zoning is CUPD-C2-2, and it also has a zoning overlay of RM2-5. So what the heck does that mean, right? So you really have to know someone down in the city. You have to do your homework. There are programs that can help you unpack this a little bit. But to really understand what kind of property you have, is you have to learn to speak that language a little bit. Okay. So right now I mentioned the density crisis here in San Diego for sure. I imagine LA is the same way. Is LA experiencing similar, the density crisis, need more units? Yeah. Okay, same with Orange County. Any Orange County people here? Yeah, okay, so it's probably pretty similar. So a big thing that has recently changed in San Diego was the law for accessory dwelling units. So it really allowed properties to put on a granny flat or a second unit to allow for more density on these properties. And it's really changed the game with real estate investing because there are so many options now that you weren't open to you in the past that are now. Okay, so what are zoning changes and where do you look for these things? So, you know, if you're in an area and it is zoned R1, and just for the sake of today, R1, single family residential, right? You can have one house on your parcel and that's it. But then all of a sudden the zoning changes to allow, let's say, for two units on that same parcel. So now what just happened to your property value? Like, it probably changed a little bit because you now have the opportunity to build another income-producing asset on that land. So getting in front of zoning changes can be quite lucrative. It can be very difficult to understand, but there are some ways to really dive into it that are available to all of us. So the city is actually pretty vocal about this. Like, you wouldn't know about it unless you're going to look for it, though. So, like, zoning changes are all discussed at what are called community planning meetings. And so typically every month or every 2 months or every quarter, I think every jurisdiction is different. I know in San Diego and most areas, you got every month, there's a community plan meeting and a community plan update. And so the planning department will put this on, and they're talking about what's happening in the area. Well, this particular area in North Park now is going to be completely changed for density and parking requirements. So before, when I was looking at this house I wanted to buy, now the numbers didn't quite make sense, but now they might because I can put another unit on it and I don't have to have that extra parking spot, which typically parking kills a lot of deals because it eats up a lot of real estate and it's hard to find the space within your parcel to make it happen. So you can get in front of these things. And if you're savvy enough to go to these meetings and to start networking, you can start to get a feel for what is going to happen. And so you can get a temperature for the community groups, right? So each community is different. And some communities will be super against the fact that they want mixed-use buildings in their neighborhood, but they are totally cool with you putting a three-story residential condo complex down the street. So you get a feeling for what everyone's like thinking, and if you get a bunch of opposition to one thing, you know you may have like a roadblock, but if you get a sentiment in the other direction, then you know that something may be cooking and you can maybe get in front of it. So San Diego recently voted to allow density bonuses to developers to include more affordable units in their project. So think of a big apartment building, and they save a portion of those units for affordable low-income housing. So typically the city will grant them tax incentives and bonuses to include more of those in the project. Now, developers don't necessarily like to do affordable housing. Why? Especially in San Diego, because the numbers don't pencil, or even in all of Southern California. You know, you're going to buy this expensive piece of land and build a bunch of units and charge rock bottom rent. It's probably not going to make sense for you to build and take the risk and to do all that. So that's why the tax incentives and the density bonuses are big. Same with mixed-use buildings. So a mixed-use building, you guys, is typically a building that is allowed for commercial, say, on the bottom floor, and then residential above it. I mean, there are other examples, but that is one. And so recently in San Diego, they just changed the ground floor height limit to 13 feet. So that now, typically, before, that could only be a two-story building. And so now that they lowered the first story height limit, you can now get a third story on that same building. So there's ways for developers to maximize their profits on something like that. And then recently, the San Diego City Council just voted to waive development impact fees and benefit assessment fees and general plan maintenance fees. Sounds like a mouthful, but in general, what I'm just saying is, like, they're trying to make the atmosphere a little easier for developers and investors to get in and start taking advantage of these areas and really creating more value and creating more housing. So, and I mentioned the parking thing. So the parking requirements are huge. Like, if any of you have looked at a development project or even just a major remodel or a small addition or whatever it is, you've probably run into the parking issue, because the city is going to want to know that there's enough parking for whatever you're building. And now they're loosening some of the requirements. So if your property is located near maybe a general transit zone, so near a bus line or something like that, now these parking requirements are being less restrictive. And so for that same accessory dwelling unit that needed one parking spot before, and there's no real estate there to build it, but now they don't need the parking spot because the bus is within like 100 yards from the property, now you can potentially build something you couldn't before. So please note that every city and jurisdiction is so different, and you need to really have specialized local knowledge. Have an architect or a draftsman or someone at the city that you know and trust. You know, it's a great idea to try to make a friend down at the city. I have a buddy that's in the building department, and I make a point to buy him lunch once a quarter, or at least go down to the department and talk to him and just pick his brain, see what's going on. These guys see it every day. They're the ones stamping your permit sets. They're the ones that really get to see what's going on. And what's cool is that, you know, these guys get hundreds of applications across their desk, and you can talk to them and say, well, hey, what's everyone doing? Like, what are the most type of projects you're seeing? Are you seeing a bunch of these accessory dwelling units, or like, what's going on? And you can get a feel for what's happening in your marketplace. Okay, where are we here? Parking, political climate. Okay, so going back to number one here on this, or number one, the first bullet point here, these council meetings. So these are big as well. And stay with me, guys, because I know some of this can get monotonous, but it's really important, especially like I'm using the San Diego example. So recently, San Diego City Council just voted to limit the amount of days that vacation rentals can be rented out for in a calendar year. Now, I knew a lot of people back a year or 2 years ago, maybe even longer than that, who were buying real estate and they were underwriting their deal based on a nightly rental that they were going to have it rented out 85% of the year, or 275 nights a year, whatever they ran their numbers at. And at that nightly rate, their return was way higher than they would get if they rented out to an annual tenant. And in general, that's the case, right? You're going to make more if you rent it out at shorter term versus longer term. And there's some of these guys now I know that are in trouble. And they have a property that they're not going to be able to rent out like they thought they were. And now they're not going to make the money they're going to make. So granted, there is probably going to be a lot of litigation, there's probably going to be lawsuits and battles back and forth between the big hotel industries and Airbnb and lobbyists and all that. Who knows how this will play out? And I'm sure that that they'll touch on this later in the vacation department, but in the vacation presentation. But it's something to pay attention to, no matter what you're looking at, the type of investment. Okay, so NIMBYs. What does that mean? Have you guys ever heard of that acronym? I'm sure some of you have, right? NIMBYs, not in my backyard. So you get a lot of people who are pro-development, pro-growth in their county, in their city, but they don't want it in their exact neighborhood, right? Like, you're going to do a development deal across the street. Like, now all of a sudden they're your biggest opponent, even though they had a different tune, you know, a few weeks ago before you bought the property. So they're serious, and they can really mess up a deal. I'll give you a couple examples. So there's a couple groups. There's one called SOHO, Save Our Heritage Organization. There's one called the La Jolla Historical Society. And so we had a project that that had to go in front of a council meeting, had to do a historical resources board, and I'll dive into that in a little bit. And the La Jolla Historical Society in SOHO showed up to the meeting with 95-year-old professors that used to teach at UC San Diego that brought up pretty much sob stories to the council members. And even though they had no basis and their logic didn't make any sense, they appealed to the emotional side of these decision makers and ended up killing the deal. And it was a very high stakes deal in La Jolla. And what I'm getting at is that these neighborhood groups and these local societies can have a lot of impact on your deal, so do not take them lightly. Okay, so Scout Red, this is cool. Anybody here using Scout Red? Nobody, wow, okay. So Scout Red, this is a really cool website. They have an app, and if you wanna know, I don't know if it works in LA, I think it does, but in San Diego, you just pull it up, type in your address or your APN, your assessor parcel number, and it'll immediately tell you how the property's zoned, and it'll give you a really good property profile on the zoning. It's really made for that. It's made to know what kind of zoning you're dealing with on your property. Now, a lot of municipalities are coming out with their own versions of this. Some already have it. San Diego's is not quite there yet, but Scout Red's a really good tool. Download the app. And or just visit their browser version. It works really well. Okay, so this is an example. This was the project that we have right now that we're going to be closing on in October. You see those two zoning designations: CUPD CT2-4, and then RM2-5. And you can see, I don't know if the numbers are too small for you guys to see, but to give you a good example, so it mentions the setbacks. And for those of you that don't know what a setback is, it's simply the space between the lot line and a structure that you can build. So if you have a lot line here, a typical setback can be 5 feet, 10 feet, 15 feet from the lot line, whatever it is, that you can have an actual structure. So if you look at these, you'll see the front setback, you'll see like the interior side setback on the left zoning says 10 feet, but on the RM2-5, it says 5 feet. Okay, well, 5 feet is going to make a huge difference in how you construct your project. So you got to know, so if you're, you know, underwriting your deal based off of one, then, and it happens to be the other, you could be in some trouble. So you really just have to really get to the bottom of this. This particular house, we had to go down to the planning department and had to find out what was going on. And they said, oh, CUPD CT2-4 was an error. It was a mapping error. So you don't have to worry about that. Be careful, get that in writing, because if you just base your project based off something vocal and it ever comes back to bite you, you have nothing. So they will put it in writing if you go through the right channels. Okay, so this is what a zoning map looks like. So this is San Diego. This is pretty much the metro area. That lower region there, Greater North Park, that's where our office is. We have some projects there right now. And you can see all the color codes. You can see the legend on the right side. Look at all that. There's so many different zonings. And what does all that mean? Like CC4-2, CD1-2. It is really hard to understand what you're dealing with. And, people I know have been doing this for 25 years still have to, verify and check. And it's just know, the rules of the game before you start to play it. Okay, so I'm going to kind of switch gears a little bit now and start talking about how we're finding potential projects. And so, mind you that I haven't talked about adding square footage yet, because that's coming next sequentially in this chapter, but this is going to apply to that as well. And so finding deals is the most important part of our business, in my opinion. You don't have deals, you don't have a job. So in real estate, it's my opinion that we're in the marketing business. Like, that's what we do, right? Like, if you work backwards from, a payday, right? So you close on a project, a house, whatever it is, a wholesale, flip, whatever you're doing, that paycheck from the escrow company goes in your bank account, and you're happy, right? That's a joyous day. But then you take a look at it and you say, well, how did this all start? Where did this profit check come from? And it originated with a lead. And if you don't have leads, you don't have a real estate business, because if you're not getting enough leads across your desk, you're not making enough offers, and you're not getting enough projects, and you're not going to make enough money, and you're not going to be in real estate very long. So don't get intimidated by this. Like, a lot of people will think, oh, well, I'm in real estate, I'm not a salesman, or I'm not in marketing. Well, you're in both. So you really need to just kind of accept it and figure out some ways to start creating some lead generation. So, and then don't give up. It works, you guys. And I'm going to show you some examples of some stuff that works. And feel free, like I said, after this meeting, whenever, to hit me up. I'm always down to talk shop when it comes to marketing. I really like this stuff. I did not used to like it. But once it starts to work, you start to, get excited about it and, network and figure out other ways and little niches to find more deals. So it's really cool. And then also, just because you're doing marketing and you're getting leads and you're looking at houses, none of that matters unless you make offers, because the amount of properties you buy this year is 100% directly correlated to the amount of offers you make. If you make one offer a month, you're probably not going to get very many deals. You make 10, you're probably going to do better. You make 100, guess what? You're probably going to get some houses. And it's just really a numbers game is really what this comes down to. Okay, so this right here is a Property Radar screenshot. So the criteria I used on this is nothing particular, but what I wanted to show you guys was how powerful this is and how much information is really right at your fingertips. It's amazing when you sit down with Property Radar what kind of stuff you can find out about people and properties. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in here using Property Radar. How many of you guys already use it? Wow, look at that. So for those of you that are not using it, look at this room. You're in a room with more than half the people using Property Radar. So, and Bruce, I know you're a big fan of Sean, and this program just keeps getting better and better, and the things you can find on here are amazing. So, for instance, you want to look for all single-family houses in 92128, which is a San Diego zip code. You want single-family. You want a lot size of 5,000 square feet. You want a house that's less than 1,000 square feet. You want it, you want it to just change ownership or only owned in the name of a trust or whatever it is. You can dial this down to so many particulars. It is amazing. And you can spit out this list. And it spits out a list of properties in your area just like this. So you can see on the left, you can literally customize this to however the heck you want. And then it'll give you a list of properties like that on the right. And you can do whatever you want with that, right? You can send out a mailer. You can get phone numbers. You can cold call. You can send a text message campaign. You can do you know, a slide dialer or something like that. There's just so many options. But my point is, there's all this info at your fingertips. These are all homeowners that may or may not want to sell. And there's just so much you can find just by taking the time to learn about this stuff. Okay, so to kind of like dial in really quick to finding potential projects, and I'm gonna touch really quick on the ADU section for a moment because I don't want to jump too far ahead. So the accessory dwelling unit, just quickly to summarize what that is, it's basically just adding a second habitable structure to an existing parcel. So whether that's a granny flat, a studio, one bedroom, whatever that is, in a nutshell, and I'm sure that that the groups, the Dossier Capital Boys will be talking about this later, and we'll get way more in depth than I will. But for instance, an architect I work with in San Diego has told me that she's finding the easiest accessory dwelling unit deals she's finding are properties that already have an existing detached garage. Why? Because the city is way more favorable to renovate an existing garage and turn it into a habitable structure rather than building ground up a brand new dwelling unit. So what can you do? Go on Property Radar and you can sift through all the properties, you can find houses that have existing detached garages, and you can send a mailer to everybody that's got a detached garage, and guess what? You're probably gonna get a phone call, and you're at least some, and you're gonna get some leads that way, and it goes back to what I just talked about the leads to offers to conversion. Okay, so what are some other ways that you can find deals? And some of this may sound old school and some of it may not, but a lot of this works. So door knocking. Has anybody here door knocked? Hands? Yeah, okay. Is it kind of intimidating like at first, or did you guys just walk into it and were totally open and had a good time? Sucks, right? Yeah, exactly, right? People give you you think that people will give you all these objections. And what I've found is that people are generally good and people are generally willing to talk to you. Now, I guess it depends on the area that you're door knocking, but in my opinion, that it's been relatively receptive. And we have bought houses by me door knocking, and so I know it works. It's not easy to do, but if you're willing to put in the elbow grease and the time, I think you guys would probably find some deals that way. Now, when someone talked to me about door knocking years ago, I was like, yeah, right, I don't want to do that. Like, next. And a lot of you probably have that sentiment, but I challenge you, if you're driving in a neighborhood that you work in, it's your market, you see a house that's got a bunch of newspapers in the front yard, you see some like utility company tags hanging on the door, or you know, a boarded up window or something, just go knock on the door. Like, what? I don't want to say nothing bad will happen because it can, and then I don't want anything coming back to me, but you guys, it's a good way to find deals. It really works. Okay, so the MLS, right? The MLS, the multiple listing service. So people think that there's no more deals on the MLS. And I challenge you to think again, because there are. There are a lot of deals on the MLS. There are a lot of deals done every day on the MLS. Granted, there are a lot of big fish in this pond. So a lot of the big boys in your market are probably combing the MLS. Some of my friends in San Diego have 6-man teams that all they do is sit on computers and look at every new listing. Phone call offers, I mean, it's kind of gross, but there's a lot of people doing it, but some do fall through the cracks. So I guess what I'm getting at is, like, on all these niches, don't just write them off, right? Because like, these work, but they're all a numbers game at the end of the day. You do it once or twice, not gonna work. You develop a system to do it consistently, it will work. Okay, let me see what my next slide is here. Okay. Perfect. Okay, so this one is big. Referrals and realtor relationships. Now, I would say our best deals in the past couple years have come from two places, and I'm going to touch on one right now, and that is realtors. And maybe not realtors that specialize in land that may want to be changed, but just realtors in general. Realtors control most of the deals done in the marketplace, you guys. Like, most of the deals are done on market. Now, how do you be the first person that realtor calls? Well, it typically just doesn't happen overnight, but if you put in the time and effort to get on that person's short list, to take this person to lunch, to bug them, to when they do bring you a deal, if it's a good deal and you perform, you do what you say you're going to do, you know, you guess what? You're going to get that phone call again. So I could do literally a whole day on lead generation, and I love this stuff. I really do. But I don't have the time today, so just file it away that this one's big, right? If you one good realtor in your back pocket can bring you multiple deals a year and feed your family for a whole year, and it's true, and I see it all the time. So just if there's a good realtor in your life, take care of them. Send them a gift card every now and then. Remind them that you're there and you want to be their first phone call. So especially if you've done business with one in the past, you know, if one's brought you a deal in the past, like, stay in front of that guy or girl. Like, they'll probably bring you another one. All right. I already mentioned Property Radar. And the next one I need to mention is mailers. So let me go back. Okay, so mail marketing. I didn't start doing this until about 2 years ago. And it's changed my life. That's for sure. Mail marketing works, you guys. And if you develop a system to do it consistently and to not only have a system to handle the leads, but to follow up. Because when you're mail marketing, it's been my experience that follow up is the key. I think we've done more deals on following up on leads that we got a while ago, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago, 6 months ago, than someone just calling me. You know, I sent a letter last week and they get my mailer on, or my letter on the Tuesday, and then they call me on Wednesday and I'm showing up at their house on Thursday and we have a contract on Friday. That happens, but in my experience, the follow-up is key. So there's a million ways to do mailers, and, you know, there's a shotgun approach, a spray and pray approach, you know, send a billion postcards and see what you get. There's a more targeted approach with, you know, more personalized letter, and everything in between. So they all work. It just depends on which way you're looking to go with it. So, but it really does work. There's some really good material out there on who's doing it and how it works. And there are also people in your marketplace that are doing it. I highly recommend network with these people, learn what they're doing, and start doing it. It works. So don't forget, mailers, a response rate is typically 1% to 2%, right? So you send out 100 postcards or letters, whatever you're sending out, you get one or two calls. That can be very demoralizing for a lot of people, because some of those calls will be, why are you mailing me this letter? I'm calling the police and this and that. And I'm telling you, I get it all the time. So just don't be discouraged with that. But out of, you know, you send 10,000 of these, guess what? Some of those are going to be legit leads and they're going to turn into deals. And my favorite part about mailers is typically you don't have any competition. It's you and the homeowner. And if you're able to get in front of a homeowner and you present yourself well, you can carry on a knowledgeable conversation. You don't seem like you're trying to be dishonest, or you're trying to steal this house from them or something like that. You know, you're a straight up person looking to do business. Like, it really works. Okay. Quickly on that. So Property Radar, which I showed you earlier, has got some really cool tools. So now they just offered like social media accounts. So, I mean, think about it. You send out a mailer, you follow it up with like a Facebook message, you follow it up with a phone call, and then you follow it up with a text message. I mean, some may say that's too much, but, and maybe it is, I don't know, but there's just a lot of cool ways to touch people and that most people aren't doing. Like, you know, I'm sure there's some people in this room, I know some people in this room actually are doing some stuff like this, but not many, that's for sure. All right, so wholesalers. How many people in this room have bought a house from a wholesaler? Okay, quite a lot actually, that's interesting. So I have two, and what I've found, especially recently, is that most wholesalers are garbage, and their analysis is off. They inflate their ARV, their after repair value, and they minimize the cost needed to get the property to where it needs to be. But if you find that wholesaler that's not garbage, that actually is honest and like knows their stuff and it makes it easy, like, hang on to those guys. They're hard to find, and they can be a steady flow of deals. The last thing I'll talk about on deal finding is whatever it is, whether it's a realtor, whether it's a mailer, whether it's MLS or door knocking, whatever it is. Go, if you get access to a good lead or a hot lead, go now. Don't go tomorrow. Don't wait till Tuesday when it's convenient for your schedule. Go now, because if you don't, somebody else will, I promise. Okay. Where are we here? Okay, working in a few different areas. So now we're talking about adding square footage, adding to an existing structure. So, you know, that's either taking a house and adding another bedroom, another bathroom, a combination of the two, adding a second story. There's multiple ways to skin this cat, and I'm going to dive into a few different ways right now. But what I want to just kind of start with is that you get this misconception, or at least I had this too when I started this, looking at adding square footage. Like, I looked at it way too vanilla. Like, I would say, oh, cool, look at this house. It's 1,000 square feet. I can add 500 square feet, and I can build it at $200 a square foot, and I can sell it for $500 a foot. And it just seems like easy math, right? Like, this should be a done deal. Does not work out like that. Sometimes it does. I can't say it does not, but typically there are way more other factors that get into the deal, and it depends on the complexity of the house and the lot and the slope and the jurisdiction and all these factors, which I'm going to touch on here in a minute. But just be careful that you're able to underwrite your deals properly, because it's usually not that simple. Okay, so any area with a low FAR. What's an FAR? That means a floor area ratio. Floor area ratio basically just means how much of the existing lot can have a structure built on it. So you have a 40% floor area ratio. 40% of your lot can actually have a built structure on it. So FAR changes in every jurisdiction, in every neighborhood. It's just different. So you got to know, before you start thinking about adding square footage, what your floor area ratio is. Okay, so I'm going to show you guys an example of some stuff we've done. So here's one house. This is in Point Loma. You guys know where that is in San Diego, like kind of on the bay. Beautiful location. So this particular house was a short sale, and we had this in escrow for almost a year before we ended up closing it. So for those of you that have bought short sales, you know they can usually take a long time. This one did. Luckily, the market was only going up, and the short sale negotiator did not renegotiate the price, and we were stoked. This turned out to be a great deal. So this little house, I think it was like, I should have brought the exact numbers, but it was like 850 square feet. It was tiny, and it had this killer view on the backside. Wait till you see it. And so what we did was we went in and we said, all right, we're going to add a bunch of square footage to this. So we added like 1,300 square feet, which is almost essentially building a new house on top of what was there. This is a beast of a project. This took over 2 years to do, and I pulled out a lot of hairs. I grew a lot of gray ones back, and I lost a lot of sleep, and these are very difficult deals. Like, there's a lot of brain damage that goes into this type of a project. And it's just not nearly as simple as, hey, let's just throw on 1,200 square feet and call it a day. And when I first got started, I didn't quite realize it. And what I want to show you guys is not to scare you not to do this stuff, because these are great deals and there could be a lot of money made, but just to show you what you need to be cautious of and aware of when you're getting into something like this, especially if you're going to be investing your hard-earned money. So this particular house, so look, it went from that small, what was that, 800 square foot little house to this sick, contemporary, mid-century modern. Like, I don't know, I should have included a picture of the view. I wish I did. But that top rooftop deck on the right has this like clear-cut, awesome view of all downtown and the bay. Like, it's amazing. And so, like I said, it took a lot to get it to this point. So here's the backyard. I mean, just overgrown and just not a nice place. And then we turned it into that, which, you know, that's really cool. And I really wanted to buy this house. I wish I had the money at the time. but, all right, here's the kitchen area. And then this got turned into a big open space with big cantina doors. This house was really cool. I really like this one. Backyard. Okay. Interesting little note on this one, and I didn't mention this in the notes, but this picture just spurred my memory. So that white fence in the back, that borders up to a vacant lot, and the vacant lot did not have any access because it was basically landlocked, if that's the right term. I'm not sure. There's an alley on this side that's not usable, hasn't been maintained, so you can't even get a car down there, and on this side there's a cliff. So what we did was I could look. I went on Property Radar, I found out who owned it, and I found out that it was the next door neighbor. So I approached the next door neighbor and I said, hey, what's going on with this lot? Like, you can't really use that. It's just sitting there. It's overgrown. What's, like, are you interested in potentially selling it? And he talked about maybe doing like a partnership deal with us, like a, hey, let's develop it or something like that. But it just didn't pencil out because of the access, right? The only way to get into this was on a cliff, and you'd have to go like subterranean parking, like do all this crazy engineering. Like it just wasn't going to pencil. So we just said, well, what about if when we were finished remodeling this house, if we potentially can work out a deal to where the new owner of this house, when we're done with it, can buy that and now blow out their backyard and now have this amazingly profitable, or desirable, I should say, property in Point Loma, because it's very hard to find lots that big, especially if you're combining two of them. So what we did was, I'm going to finish through some of these pictures. So you can see like a lot of glass, a lot of cantina door systems, and some really nice wood kitchen before. And what's funny is in this kitchen, we like see the appliances. They're actually not terrible. They weren't disgusting. So we took those out and put them into a property that was, you know, like we had a condo that we were renovating, and we brought those, put it into a condo, and sold the condo, and it worked great. So don't be afraid to recycle your appliances. This was the kitchen. We took these photos before the house was finished, because we actually put the house in escrow. We found a buyer prior to it being completed. So we already had this house in escrow, had a deposit down, had a done deal essentially, but we still staged it. We still spent like $3,000, oh, it was more than that. I think we spent like $4,000 in staging to stage this beautiful house, because we wanted it for our portfolio. We wanted the photos, right? Look how beautiful these came out. So the interior still had some things, right? You see the wires hanging down. We didn't have the pendant lights put up yet, but better than nothing. Okay, so when you're adding to an existing structure, you have to really work backwards. So when you're running your numbers, you're underwriting your deal, I like to work backwards. I say, okay, if we're adding 1,000 square feet, what will this house be worth when we're done? And I feel like it's probably just the right way in general to do it. And when you're doing that, like that's the key. Like, if you can't accurately estimate that number, then you really can't do this niche, because if you're off by even a little bit, can kill your deal, and it can go from a profitable deal to one that you lose money on. So you got to think like an appraiser. I take a lot of pride in this on our flips or on whatever we're doing as a realtor. Like, the appraisal is everything. Show up, meet the appraiser there, give them comps, give them a list of upgrades, give them everything to coach them to your number. And I found if you do that, you're probably going to be pretty successful. If you're comparing comps and you're using a price per square foot metric, so, hey, the house next door is 1,000 square feet and it's selling at $500 a square foot. Okay, that's great. But we're building a 2,000 square foot house. So should we be able to sell ours for $500 a square foot? The answer is probably no, because in usually any market that we've been in, the smaller house will always sell for a higher price per square foot than the bigger house next door to it. It's just how it works. So just be careful of that when you're running your numbers. Okay, so I'm going to let Bruce talk about this later, but it works best as quadrant number 4 matures into a full-blown explosion of both prices and interest. So, I mean, yeah, that makes sense, right? You have this price appreciation. You know, the market is not as insane as it was for us in San Diego like 6 months ago, a year ago. Lenska, I think you could probably vouch for that, right? But we're still seeing some strong sales numbers, strong pricing. So I think this model still works really great in this current market climate. So every city is different. Like I mentioned, the time and cost will vary literally from one city line to the next, sometimes from across the street to not, because one is on a sensitive habitat, the other is not. There's so many variables, and you really gotta do your homework before you get into one of these. Lease foreclosure competition and trustee sales, I think this is in here because the price damage that a foreclosure will do to a market. You know, you have all these beautiful homes that are selling traditional sales, and then there's that one foreclosure. Now there's three foreclosures, and they're bringing the comps down. I think, you know, that's, you guys be careful of that. Okay, so this is important, and I'm going to give you guys a lot of stuff about things we've run into here, and give you some notes. And a lot of it is not in the slides, but it's just stuff that I've run into over the years. And feel free to take notes if you'd like, because I think you guys will get a lot from this next segment. Okay, so, right, so you find a house, you put it under contract, you have your diligence period, you want to figure out, hey, do I really have a good deal here? So I'm going to do my homework. So doing your homework is very important, as we all know, and it really starts with, like, you want to find out what's the possibility I can get this project approved and hit my numbers at the end of the day. Like, that's what we're doing here. So the city is understaffed, they're overworked, they're underpaid, and frankly, they do not care if your project gets approved or not. Now, I met with my friend down at the building department yesterday in kind of preparation for this today. I wanted to take his current temperature of what was going on down there. And he's just like, he gave me the analogy. He's like, dude, we are the referees. You guys are playing the game. We don't care who wins or loses. We just want to make sure that everyone's playing by the rules. And so, and I asked him to elaborate on that. And he's like, well, I don't care if you build your accessory dwelling unit. I just need to make sure that it's, that it's safe and habitable and it's done the right way. And if it's not, then, like, sorry, you don't get to build it. So remember that when you're submitting your plans or whatever it is you're doing. Like, at the end of the day, the city doesn't care about your project. But on the flip side of that, I found that they're usually pretty helpful, right? They're not there to kill your deal. If you show up and you're like, you take an honest approach, you're pleasant, you're not an adversarial approach kind of person, they're probably going to be willing to talk to you and help you, and that's their job, right? So don't be afraid of going down to the city. A lot of people have this ominous take of planning and permitting, and granted, there's a lot that goes into it and a lot to be wary of, but it's really not that bad, and they're there to help. They really are. Okay, so, another big one, utility companies, you guys. Like, so planning is one thing, but the utility company is another. So let's say you're adding 1,000 square feet and you're putting in all these badass appliances and a spa on the rooftop deck and whatever. Well, you're probably going to need to upgrade your electrical panel. Okay, well, what does that look like? So I'm going to touch on an experience we had on that in a second, but just keep that in mind because utility companies play a big role and they usually take a long time to get in the docket and get these things through the gates. So, like, gas meters, another thing. I made a mistake one time, big mistake. We bought this house that was condemned, red tagged by the city, and perfect flip, right? It was from a mailer, like, it was the house, the best or the ugliest house in an awesome, hot neighborhood, been boarded up for a year, and the guy just happened to get my mailer when they were looking to sell it. They had just gotten the documents, the court appropriated documents, and now they're ready to sell. And so I did my walkthrough with my contractor. We did everything. We had all our numbers. And I made the mistake of not noticing that there was no gas meter. So, and I didn't notice it till after we bought it. And then once we bought it and closed, we were going to be doing a termite fumigation. For those of you familiar with that, you need to turn the gas off for that. And so they went out there and like, oh, well, there's no meter. And so I was kind of taken back on that, and it took a long time for us to get a meter. It took about 3 months, and you need to hire a specialized contractor. You can't just have your brother do it or your general contractor. They have to have a specific license, and they have to have a specific permit, and they're usually very expensive, and because you're working with a high-pressure gas line, and I'm sure some of you remember like explosions in like San Mateo, I think there was one, and some other stuff. So now they're super careful about what you do with a high pressure line. So going to touch on that in a second. Okay, so look at that. So you guys see that white line, that dash line down there? So this was a house that we bought that we were adding square footage to and submitted our plans, and they said, yeah, great, cool. We had a 50-amp electrical panel on the property. We needed a 200-amp because we were doing a lot of cool electrical to the house. And they said, okay, great. Well, let's upgrade your panel. But if you guys want a new panel, I'm sorry, but the lines are antiquated, and you're going to have to trench 200 feet up your street and to tie in and replace everything that's there. And, I mean, does that sound fair? I mean, no, that doesn't sound fair. Like, why do we have to do that just to get a new electrical panel? But they did not care at all. It's like, cool, then don't get your panel. But we obviously, it was a $3 million house, like, you need electrical. So we had to wear it, and we bit the bullet and did it. Now, This, and something like this, too, it's not as straightforward as just doing some trenching. You now have to submit for what's called a traffic control permit, which you guys know those guys in the street with the orange flags and, like, directing traffic? Okay, well, they're not cheap. And you have to hire them to manage traffic because now you are encroaching the public right away. So it's just this mess that, like, it turns into a nightmare. And like, we knew not to expect that, and we learned a lesson. So you better believe now when we're looking at a project like this, we've scaled back large projects like this in general, but if we do look at one, we take all this into account. And we had to learn the hard way in order now to know. So you guys don't learn the hard way. Learn from me. I forgot the linear foot amount, but all in, I think this cost like upwards of $60,000. Yeah. All right. Okay, let me go back here, actually. Okay, so here are some other issues that you can run into. Okay, so timing is everything, right? So you buy one of these houses, and most of you guys are going to be using financing, and financing is expensive, especially on these spec projects. So what are you paying? 10%, 12%, 8%, whatever the number is, you're paying a lot of money every month. So every day that goes by, you're spending a lot of money. Like on our flips now, like if we're doing like just your cookie cutter $600,000 house in San Diego, I think it's like $275 bucks a day. It seems to end up be like what we're paying. I believe when you factor in everything, all carrying costs, taxes, insurance, and financing. And so you figure, you know, just 5 days goes by and there's over $1,000 that you just burned. So timing's everything. How fast is your architect? How good is your architect? Do you want to use a draftsman instead? A draftsman, you guys, is like an architect without the license. And typically they work for an architect that can stamp their stuff. So if you're doing a smaller deal, recommend starting with a draftsman, and they can usually get most of the stuff done your architect can for a fraction of the price. If you're working in a strict area or an area that has a lot of regulation, you need a local architect, right? Like if you're in San Diego, if you're in La Jolla, doing the La Jolla project, which is a very affluent area, you need a La Jolla architect. Why? Because they know everybody. They've done it 100 times here before. They know what you're going to run into. I'm going to explain a couple of these things that can get in your way. And I mean, some of it sounds like a movie, really. Some of these things that can get in your way of doing a deal, and like you didn't even know they existed. Like it's crazy. So, all right, engineering issues. So structural engineers. So for those of you who don't know what they do, they're the people that come in and make sure the house is built safe. So that, you know, the steel and the beams you use are not going to collapse on the people living there. They're there to make sure that the property is built structurally sound. In a nutshell, right? There's a lot more they do, but that's in a nutshell. So a lot of these structural engineers will cover their ass. They will over-engineer your property, right? They'll add structural steel in places you don't need it. They'll add beams in places you don't necessarily need it. They'll, you know, add all this extra engineering. And granted, you need to be safe, right? You don't want a builder defect lawsuit down the line. You want to build safe houses just in general. But a lot of times they'll over-engineer it. It costs a lot of money, and you need your architect to be able to help you kind of scale that down a little bit. Okay, geological engineers. So before I started doing this, I didn't even know what that was. Simply stating, they're there to test the geology, the soils, make sure that whatever you're building on, the soil you're building on, is suited for that soil, right? There's all kinds of soils, and like I didn't know about this stuff until like I had to learn it. You know, you don't learn this stuff in geology class in high school. You know, there's clay soils, there's soft soils, there's rocky soils, there's all kind of soil, and they all have a different rating as to what can be built on it and how strict and how strong your foundation and your underpinning has to be. So be careful of that because it can be quite a bit, and it gets quite expensive. It's really cool though. Like if you get a soils test, make sure you're there that day to watch them do it. It's a pretty cool experience. All right, backlog of city projects. So know your city, right? Like in San Diego, we have an incorporated city called Chula Vista. And right now Like their projects are taking 12 months to get a stamp permit. That's crazy. Where in another location, it may be taking 3 or 4 months. So just know if you're working in a specific area, what you're looking at. Sensitive habitat. I see this a lot in San Diego. So make sure there are no endangered plant species. Like we have pine trees called Torrey pines. And if you have one on your property, it's there forever. You're not getting it taken down. And if you didn't know that was a Torrey pine when you bought the property and your plan was to demo the trees and build there, like you'd be in trouble. So keep that in mind. Hillside slope. So slopes are tough. They're just tough to build on, right? Like the soil condition is typically tough on slopes because that's why it's a slope. Like it's eroding, like it's not flat and stable. So, your building and your engineering is going to be bumped up quite a bit for something like that. A slope has a fire problem, right? Like it's straight up. So what happens? A fire at the bottom of the hill burns up, burns all your brush and vegetation. Now you have to have a fire issue. It typically means you have to have brush clearing. So all these things you just want to like budget for. And then if you're on a slope, sometimes you have to build below grade. So when you think about it, if you're on a slope and you're building below the grade on the slope, and let's say you put a bathroom at the very bottom of your slope, but your sewer line's up here. Well, how do you get, you know, the liquids and solids from the bottom up to the sewer line? Well, you have to use sewage ejector, a sump pump, and it's not that big of a deal, but it's an extra cost. They typically require maintenance and breakdown, so there are just these things to think about when you're analyzing a potential deal. Okay, so this one's big, historical. So what does that mean? It's going to be a blessing and a curse. Sometimes a property may be designated for historical designation. Like I said, a good thing and a bad thing. A good thing is sometimes it can give you a huge tax break through something called the Mills Act, or it can just completely change what you can build on the property, right? So there's a lot of restrictions on a historical resource that limits what you can build, and typically some of the criteria are, did a famous architect build this house? So Frank Lloyd Wright. Was the home lived in by a famous person, you know, which was the case in a house we bought? Is it in a historical area or historical part of the town? So it's you need to make sure that you know if the house you're buying is in a historical area, if there's any historical significance whatsoever, because it took us 2 extra years on a house to deal with the historical issues. So it can really, really mess up a deal. Stormwater. So we're seeing a lot more of this. Like this is becoming a huge, huge issue with the city. So what's happening when it rains? Where's your water displacing? And sometimes now they're requiring stormwater retention basins. So you got to have like dig a pit and put this tank in an area on your property so stormwater can run off to it. I mean, it's, in my opinion, it's a little over the top, but just know that you're going to get into those if you're doing a larger deal. HOAs, man, these are my nemesis these days. HOAs are so tough. I mean, even just to change a paint color or change an exterior window is getting so incredibly tough. Like, for instance, a lot of these HOAs will have architectural committees, and they have a lot of power. And let's say you want to do a project and everything you're going to do meets city building requirements and code, but it doesn't quite meet the HOA's code or requirements, then guess what? They have the final say, and you will not get to do that deal. So in escrow, when you're buying a property, you're always going to get a copy of the HOA documents. I highly recommend you read them very well. They're a pain in the butt. They come with a set of CC&Rs, codes, covenants, and restrictions, and they are a pain in the butt. They're typically written 50 years ago. They're in fonts that are hard to read, and they've been scanned like 7 times, and you're not quite sure what you're reading sometimes. But if your plan is to rebuild the property, you gotta do it, and you gotta do your diligence, because these HOAs will crawl up your you-know-what, and they make it a huge problem. And I guess I might sound a little bitter because we have a couple right now that have just been nightmares. I mean, like some of these committees only meet once a quarter. And if they give you a no on your first attempt, then they say, okay, cool, well, I'll get back to you in 90 days when we have our next meeting. And it's like, how does that make sense? How's that helping your neighborhood? But anyway, moving on. Okay, title issues, right? So read your title reports, guys, and have a good title rep. And I know that may sound redundant, but have a good title guy on your team. There's so many issues that you can get in front of by just having someone explain to you what you're reading on a title report. There's a lot of verbiage in there that's not very easy to understand, and I still don't understand it all. I'll call my title guy if I have any questions whatsoever, and I'd rather have the professional tell me and put it in writing, put it in an email, explain to me what I'm looking at. So always ask for a set of plotted easements from your title company. They'll give you a little map, and it'll show you on the map if there's any easements, right? You have a utility easement, a sewer line, an underground electrical line, or something to where you can't build on that particular part of your parcel. So you got to know what you're buying. Okay, this is another big one. Unpermitted additions or code violations. So we have this example right now. We have a house that has an unpermitted granny flat, unpermitted master bathroom, and an unpermitted guest bathroom. And so, what do you do with that? So there's a lot of things that can happen with that, but if your plan is to renovate this house and add square footage or whatever you're going to do, the city is going to want to know that these other unpermitted additions are done right. And they're either A, going to make you open them up and show them and get them drawn out and planned and stamped, or they're going to make you tear them down. So just know that, look at your title report. Like, are you buying a house with 1,000 square feet, but you walk the house and you're like, wait a minute, this feels like there's like 2,000. What's going on here? Just be cognizant of that, because it happens a lot. And sometimes it's not a big deal. You can get it through the gates, no problem. But other times it was done really poorly, and it may come to bite you. If you think you're buying X square footage and you're paying for more than what you're actually getting because you have to tear it down. So just take a look at that. And the city will want it corrected before they give you a permit. Okay, just another little thing, like managing a job site. Let's say you're in construction, right, and it rains. That building inspector happens to be driving by your project, and you're not managing the stormwater properly, and there's dirt running off your job site. They're gonna give you a violation, and so it's just all these like things to keep in mind when you're doing a bigger deal like that, adding square footage. It's not for the faint of heart, but you can make a lot of money doing it. Always budget for more time and extra cost, guys. These things always take longer than you expect and always cost more. For those of you who have done it, I'm sure you'd agree with that. If you hit on time and on budget, that is the minority. And you celebrate when that happens, but it does not happen very often. So I have about 15 minutes right here. Is what you said? Okay, all right. So let's see here. Okay, good. I'm doing good. So another one, Coastal Commission. Coastal Commission, you guys, can be your worst enemy. They're pretty much there to make sure the property that you're building on, there's no environmental issues and you don't disturb anything. Let me go back here. So the Coastal Commission is there to make sure that your project is sound. For instance, like the Coastal Commission has 1,100 miles of coastline that they manage, and they only have 140 full-time employees. So if your project needs to get through Coastal Commission, then just factor in a bunch of extra time. I've seen it take almost over a full year to get your project through Coastal Commission. So if you have to be done, know what you're getting into. There are some ways around it. A good architect can keep 50 to 55%, I forgot the actual number, of your existing walls. And if they do that, it can be Coastal Commission exempt. So talk with your architect when you're looking through that. Okay, let me go on here. Okay, what was this example I got here for you? Okay, perfect, good example. Okay, so remember I talked about the historical thing, or if it's historically designated, it could really screw up your project. So look how cool this house was. This is the rendering that our architect gave us for this awesome house in La Jolla. And we're doing this mid-century modern look. It was really hot in that neighborhood. We knew this thing would just fly off the market. This would have been a home run. So this was what was submitted to the city. And a few weeks into the permitting process, they let us know that it did not pass historical. There was a potential historical figure that lived in this house. Started this whole chain reaction of stuff that we had to do. So that's the front, and I'll explain that in a second. That's the front. That's the back. So, this is actually a pretty modest rendering. The way this house turned out in the back was way sicker than what this looks. But just for my point here is, this is what we were able to build. So look at that for a second, right? You have this like ranch style home, brick, board and batten. Like, I mean, look at the garage. Like, we had to put those wood slats back on it to make it look like the front of the house when the historical figure lived in it. So we had this really cool modern look, right, that is going to sell immediately that everybody wants. But no, we had to put that, which is how the house looked, because that's the way. So the criteria that the board uses, I mean, I don't understand how this is an objective criteria, but it's, they said, would the historical figure recognize the house if she were alive today? How the hell do you know? You know? So we're like, so, I mean, that's what I mean. Like, you don't want to get involved. Like, those deals, you just pass on it because it's just so much of a nightmare. But, I mean, look, the house came out pretty sick. Like, this is a cool house. We ended up selling it for over $3 million the first week on the market. So, I mean, it worked out well. But this house came out really cool. So, backyard pool, and I wish I were... I should have brought a picture of it. I didn't. Dang it. Okay, so that pool, you guys, was not always like that. So do you guys remember about a year and a half ago, we had those gnarly rains here in California, Southern California? It was like once in 100 years. Like, I forgot like the dates. I think it was like a year ago Christmas. So the previous pool that was here, the contractor was redoing the plaster. And anytime you redo plaster, you pull water out of a pool, you have to put a hole in the bottom of the pool because there's hydrostatic pressure coming up from underground that if you don't, the pool will pop up in the air. Exactly. You're familiar. So I wish I would have brought a picture because it's such a cool picture, but we showed up one morning and our pool was 6 feet in the air. And there is no way to salvage it. There was no way around it, and we just had to demo it and rebuild another one. We went through insurance, and I wish we didn't because we didn't. And they ended up denying it, saying it was an act of God. So just be careful. When you're redoing a pool, put a hole in the bottom. Okay, this was the front of the house. So you can see how like we kept – it had to look the same. We just changed a few things, but essentially we just made it nice. We couldn't do too much to the front. So here's the living room. Turn it into that. Kitchen, not very nice. And turn it into that. This was the living room, which we turned into the master bedroom. It's cool views all the way up to Orange County from San Diego. It was really cool. Backyard, this was a video. I think I just screenshotted it though. But I mean, turned it into an outdoor lounge. I mean, this house was pretty impressive. So you can see what you can do with some of these houses. So, all right, I got about 10 minutes, and I'm going to get through some of this stuff quickly. All right, so like I mentioned earlier, know your cities. Why? Because there's a certain city in San Diego called Poway, and there's this little rule called the Minor Development Review Application. If you build 750 or more square feet, add that to your property, you now have to do this lengthy one-year review process. If you build 749 or less, then it's a very less strict process. 2 or 3 months, you're in and out the door with a permit. Which one would you rather have, right? The 2 or 3 months. So you build 749 or less, and you now circumvent this huge process. So just know what you're getting into. Like, talk to people in your market. Like, what do I need to know in this particular city? All right? When looking at a deal like this, I personally would rather look for a house that allows me to go out, not up. Why? Because going up requires underpinning your foundation. It requires changing your roof line. It requires a lot of extra stuff that, in my opinion, is more costly and more difficult. So I would personally rather find a house that has a nice, flat, usable lot. I can slap on an extra bedroom, bath, whatever you want to do. It's going to be a lot easier to get done. Okay, so looking for a smallest house with a larger lot. So typically, it's a good idea, right? If you're looking in a small house or in a big house neighborhood and you find that one that's a small house, like that, there's probably some upside there to make it like kind with the rest that are in, in that area. Okay, so some of the people you're going to need. And this list is long, but I'm gonna go through this quickly. So engineers, I already talked about structural. So civil, geotechnical, and other engineering. You're gonna learn more about engineering than you ever thought possible in like a 2 month process because, you don't really have a choice. So these are some of the contractors that are needed, some of the subcontractors. So, right, you need a demo crew, you need framing, you need electrical, plumbing, roofing, finished carpentry, and so on and so forth. So this is a full-time job, you guys. If you're going to do a larger renovation or a square footage addition, and you think you're going to, okay, I'm going to hire the demo crew myself, I'm gonna find a framer, and I'm going to have him bid it out, and then I'll get the electrical guy in here, and then I'll coordinate it, make sure they're all doing that at the right time. No, it's a full-time job. I can't say no because some people like that, but I personally would rather just hire a general contractor. They're going to take a piece of the pie, but you're going to have a lot less headaches. Okay, let's see here. Okay, so here's one tip. So, know your buyer, right? Like, if your buyer is worth like $75 million and they have a legal team at their disposal and they have all these resources, like, just know what you're getting into, right? Like, obviously, if you're selling someone like that a property, like, you have a pretty nice piece of real estate, but just know that you're not playing with the big boys. Anything comes back to bite you, like, buckle up, because they're going to have some resources at your disposal. A couple other tips. So the city building inspector doesn't really do too much. Let me show you why. And I can't say that completely, because the building inspectors, I can't say that about everyone. And matter of fact, so I take that back. I just say that sometimes they don't do their job. So be careful. This house was signed off on, right? The building card, all the insulation was signed off on. But do you guys see any insulation under there? No. So who messed that up, right? Like, our contractor didn't get the insulation subcontractor into the house. The building inspector didn't even crawl underneath there to look at it, but he signed off on it saying it was there. So you imagine when we get a home inspection in escrow with our buyer, and they show us this, and we're like, well, we have a permit card. I mean, so just be careful, right? Okay, a couple other things here. Always, always, always have the right insurance. And you never need insurance until you need insurance. And it is, it's a language I still don't quite fully speak, but it's one that if you're going to do larger deals, like, you really need to understand it, because if it comes back to you, then you need to be covered properly. So project and completed operations coverage, and this may not apply to everybody, but if you're doing some of these larger deals, talk to your insurance carrier about project and completed ops coverage. Also be added as an additionally insured on your general contractor's liability policy. It gives you way more leverage if you have to do anything. And again, you guys, talk to your representation about this and do your own diligence. But for us, that's what we found. All right, disclose everything. So actually, hold on, I'll tie that, I have a few more minutes here, five more minutes. So this is what a set of plans looks like, okay? So this is not what a set of plans looks like. This is what one page of a set of plans looks like. So, you know, when I first got into this and I got the first set of plans, I had no clue what I was looking at. I had to have the architect show me everything. I took one home. I had him print up one for me. I had to pay him a few bucks because they're not cheap. And I took it home and I studied everything. I highlighted it. I just tried to figure out what I was looking at so I could speak knowledgeably, because I was a fish out of water. I had no clue. So if you guys want to get into this, like, maybe like ask a buddy, like, hey, let me look at your set of plans and just like study it for a little while so you can get familiar with what something looks like. So I have a few other tips that I want to give you before I leave here, because these have always helped me as well. Disclose everything. So whether you just did a little flip and all you did was carpet and paint, or you added 1,000 square feet and you had a historical figure living in your house and you had a flood and you had a pool pop up in the backyard, whatever it is, like, disclose it, over-disclose it, right? Like, don't be afraid that, hey, if I tell this buyer everything, they're going to walk. And if that's the case, that was not your buyer anyway, and you didn't want that person owning your real estate, because it'll probably come back to bite you later. So just be transparent, and it'll save you in the long run. Non-disclosure lawsuits are huge right now in real estate. They're some of the largest volume of lawsuit, of real estate litigation is non-disclosure. So just disclose it. Not worth it. Find a mentor and or a partner. You know, there's a lot of guys doing this stuff, and you know, pick somebody's brain. Like, most people are receptive and open, right? Like, take someone out to coffee, take them out to lunch, bug them. At some point, if they say no, at some point they'll cave and they'll show you what you need to know. And you know, I think they respect that too. You know, it's like persistence is a quality that I think people respect. And one of my friends who he flips like 70 houses a year, and one of the first things he said to me was when he wholesaled me a deal, and I asked him, "Oh, how'd you get this? There was like 20 offers on it." He's like, "Ah, the squeaky wheel gets the grease," and that stuck with me, and it's so true. And I apply it now to mostly all these deals that we're doing. All right, surround yourself with people that are doing what you want to do. I mean, you guys are in this room already. I don't think I need to tell you that, but it's so true. Like, if you surround yourself with guys, say you wanna add square footage to houses, well, surround yourself with a few of those guys or girls that are doing it, and you'll probably pick up a thing or two, and you'll probably find yourself in a good position. You drive a lot. I do. Looking at houses or whatever we're doing. Books on tape, podcasts, been great learning tools. I mean, the Norris Group's podcast, I listen to all the time. I mean, along like with a myriad of others, it's been really helpful. This one's big. Keep a deal journal. So every time you finish a deal, make it a point to sit down with your team. Whether if that's just you, that's fine. Or if you have a five-person team, sit down, go over your wins and your losses. And there are different ways people approach this, right? Like how they structure their deal journal, but at least have something that memorializes what went right, what went wrong, and what you're going to do next time. It's powerful. It really is. And then you look back at a deal you did 3 years ago, and you're like, I was such an idiot. But it kind of humbles you, and it's a good tool. Go to the RIAs. They're great. I mean, sometimes it's you know, kind of a pain on a Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock to drive 30 minutes north. But you know, it's so good. Like you'll meet people if you keep going that really open doors for you. Start a mastermind group. They're so powerful. You get in a group of like-minded individuals, a small group where you can talk intimately about deals, about mindset, whatever it is. Like it's really helpful. And then last is like get out and do something, right? You can come to 100 of these trainings and seminars and whatever, but I mean, you can't, I forgot, I think this was Mike who taught me this that I heard in his training. Like you can't learn to ride a bike in a seminar. And like, it's so true. Like if you can come to all these things, you get analysis paralysis, whatever people call it, but like get out and do some deals, make some offers, make some friends, do whatever it is. And like, I promise good things will start to happen. But yeah, that's all I got. Thank you, guys.